What does it mean to truly live after you've lost your reason for living? Ove knows the answer all too well. At 59, 6 months after his beloved wife Sonia's death, he's methodically planning his exit from a world that no longer makes sense. He covers the floor with plastic sheets, not for himself, but so real estate agents won't have to clean up the mess. He turns Sonia's photograph toward the shed so she won't have to watch. Even in death, he's thinking about others, though he'd never admit it. This is the beautiful paradox at the heart of Frederick Backman's global phenomenon, a man everyone calls grumpy, who possesses the most generous heart imaginable. Every morning at 6, Ove patrols his residential area with military precision, kicking the traffic sign 3 times, inspecting garage doors, tracking vehicles overstaying guest parking. This isn't obsession, it's a man clinging to order in a world that took everything from him. His rigidity pervades everything. He drives only Saabs, boycotted a shop for going card only, and refuses a 3 kroner flower surcharge on principle. At an electronics store, he demands a computer, a proper tower, like computers are supposed to have. This inflexibility stems from his railway worker father's worldview. Humanity divides into those who can back up trailers and fix radiators, and those who cannot. He reserves contempt for men in white shirts, bureaucrats making rules without understanding consequences. When new neighbors scrape his mailbox while struggling with a trailer, Ove takes over, expertly maneuvering it while muttering about people these days. His father taught him that men are what they do, not what they say, a lesson Ove carries like gospel. Ove's gruff exterior conceals a profound love story. Their romance sparked when he impulsively boarded the wrong train after spotting Sonia brown hair, blue eyes, red shoes, yellow clasp. She brought color to his monochrome existence. Her red cardigan made the rest of the world look as if it were made in grayscale. She loved literature and music. He understood screwdrivers and oil filters. Their bond lived in intimate gestures, Sonia folding her index finger into Ove's palm, a detail he aches for. When she became pregnant, his response captured everything. "We'll have to get a Saab station wagon then." A bus accident in Spain paralyzed Sonia and cost them their child. While doctors offered grim predictions, she refused despair. "We can busy ourselves with living or with dying." Ove rebuilt their home with ramps, battled bureaucracy for her rights, and constructed a school ramp when officials refused. When she died whispering, "Everything will be fine, darling Ove," nothing was. He didn't die when Sonia left. He stopped living. Now he visits her grave daily, whispering, "I miss you." After his mother's death when he was 6, Ove was raised by his railway worker father, a quiet, principled man who worked night shifts maintaining tracks. Their modest life centered on practical skills, feeding birds, playing cards, understanding engines. The pivotal moment came when they rebuilt a damaged Saab 92 together, working under dim garage light, dismantling and rebuilding the engine piece by piece. Ove learned about precision and doing things properly. That night, he decided he would never drive any car but a Saab. At 16, his father died in a railway accident. Displaying stubborn integrity, Ove refused all charity, even returning his father's unearned wages. He immediately took a railway job, abandoning his education. When his childhood home burned down, bureaucrats offered a reduced market price for his land. This wasn't just property, this was where every floorboard held a memory. When coworker Tom stole his father's watch, Ove marched naked and dripping from the shower across workers' accommodation, retrieved his watch, and knocked Tom out with a single punch. That was the moment he decided what kind of man he would be, one who stood his ground. Ove's isolation shatters when Parvane, a pregnant foreign woman, backs her trailer into his mailbox. Her persistence matches his stubbornness. When she needs driving lessons, she manipulates him into teaching her. As she stalls, facing harassment from other drivers, Ove delivers what she'll always remember as his loveliest compliment. "You've given birth to 2 children, and soon you'll squeeze out a third. You fled war and persecution, learned a new language, got an education, and hold together a family of incompetents. I'll be damned if I've seen you afraid of anything before now. Parvaneh's daughters form their own connections. 3-year-old Nasanin draws him as the only figure in vibrant colors. You're the funniest thing she knows. The 7-year-old eventually calls him Granddad at her birthday party, leaving Ove speechless. Ove accumulates a community of misfits. Jimmy, a young man Sanja fed, Adrian, a postman she taught, and Mirsad, a gay youth rejected by his father. Even a scraggly, one-eared cat becomes an unlikely companion. After rescuing it from a snowdrift, Ove feeds it tuna despite insisting it will live in his house over his dead body. At Sanja's grave, he introduces it. This is the cat annoyance. It's living with us now. As Ove kneels whispering, "I miss you," the cat gently rests its head in his palm, two broken beings finding unexpected connection. Ove's war against faceless bureaucracy becomes literal when social services attempts to institutionalize Rune, who has Alzheimer's, against his wife Anita's wishes. This mirrors Ove's past. After the bus accident paralyzed Sonia, he wrote countless letters demanding accountability, only to be stonewalled. When the council refused to build a ramp at her school, Ove built it himself. When a white-shirted bureaucrat arrives to take Rune, Ove blocks his car with a trailer. The official smugly declares, "A decision is a decision," prompting Ove to organize the community. The resistance culminates at Anita and Rune's house. As the official arrives with nurses, Anita blocks the doorway. What sort of love is it if you hand someone over when it gets difficult? The entire neighborhood steps forward. Ove, Parvaneh, Patrick, Jimmy, Anders, Adrian, and Mirsad, all pledging to help care for Rune. Journalist Lena produces documentation of bureaucratic irregularities, while Patrick reveals they have the man's bank statements and compromising web history. Faced with exposure, the bureaucrat retreats. As Ove tells Sonia's gravestone, "You'll just have to wait a bit longer for me up there. I don't have time to die right now because there's a bloody war on." Ove's suicide attempts, plastic sheets, precisely positioned stool, calculated 5-foot drop, are interrupted by crisis. A cat needs rescue, Parvaneh needs driving lessons, Mirsad needs shelter. His reasons for living multiply: fixing radiators, feeding the cat, fighting for Rune and Anita. The climax arrives when Ove confronts burglars and collapses with chest pain. At the hospital, the doctor diagnoses an enlarged heart, causing Parvaneh to burst into hysterical laughter. The grumpy man whose heart was supposedly too small has been suffering from a heart too large. Life unfolds in new seasons. Ove carries photos of Parvaneh's baby everywhere, grumbling about incompetent neighbors while privately admitting to Sonia's grave that it can be quite nice having something to get on with. 4 years later, Parvaneh shows Ove has peacefully passed away, the cat's head resting in his palm. His meticulously organized affairs reveal over 11 million kronar distributed among the children he'd come to love. Despite his instructions for no funeral fuss, over 300 people attend with candles engraved Sonia's Fund, a charity Parvaneh creates for orphaned children. The novel ends with Parvaneh showing Ove's house to a young couple. When the husband mentions his sob, she knows Ove's home has found its rightful owner. Grief doesn't diminish our capacity for connection, it expands it.